You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, August 19th, 2015. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, catching up on some stories we've touched on in the past. The SEC admits that it really doesn't monitor the even loose rules on stock buybacks. Important stuff, folks, and pretty stunning. Could very well be a big issue in this year's campaign. Should very well be a big issue for those of you who sent emails and comments on that last interview we did with Bill Lozonik a while back from UMass on one of the major factors contributing to wealth and income inequality in this country. This will have a lot of relevance for you, especially. Also, Sam Brownback's right-wing experiment in Kansas continues to fail in a massive way. And it actually gets worse as time gets on. Because even though we are just incrementally experiencing an improvement in our economy, it's just going the opposite direction in Kansas. We will touch on that as well as the massive lack of teachers developing across the country. In many respects, no surprise. And we, of course, because it is election season, I mean, we're only 13, 14 months away. We'll have plenty of updates on the race. I mean, you know, one thing I want to, you know, we're going to touch on today. We also have some sound that will be playing today. I will also take on the notion of some type of broad truce between progressives and new atheists. I'm not even sure I even know what any of those words I just said even mean. But to the extent that I can, I will address that briefly. Tomorrow on the program, just before I jump into this, someone tweeted me the other day. And for the life of me, I apologize. I don't know who it was off the top of my head. And she said, you should have this guy on to debate. He's a comedian and apparently has a couple of podcasts or is on part of a podcast. And I knew nothing about him other than she had said he's spewing libertarian BS. And that was basically all it took.
And yeah, I'll do it.
Yeah, it's really, in many respects, it's like as I'm relating this, I almost feel embarrassed on how little it took. But it's just right now, I guess I'm just in the mood for an argument. I don't know if things are just getting, you know, I think Milo has been too well behaved as of late. I'm not sure exactly what it is. But I have invited him on. And I have subsequently listened to one or two things. He seems like a pretty intelligent guy. I think he does. I think, and forgive me, I haven't confirmed this, and I don't want to misspeak, but I do think he self-identifies as a libertarian. And we're going to probably try and keep the conversation and the debate, to the extent that it's a debate, to the areas of economics and free markets and unicorns. I guess I shouldn't editorialize when I'm talking about what we're going to talk about.
That's really conceding a lot of grounds when you open that area.
I'm just saying, if we're going to debate free markets, the efficacy of free markets, we should also talk about maybe the efficacy of unicorns. That's all I'm saying.
I can't really hear what you're saying.
No, he sounds like a bright guy. So it should be interesting. And he's also, he's a comedian. So it should be entertaining. I just find that comedians generally at least have a little bit higher degree of self-awareness. And this guy's not going to take me into territory of like, well, if you have, if you wanted to have intercourse with someone who is below age, you know, I don't want to get into that type of
13.
All right. So let's move on. Oh, okay.
There's a real head scratcher.
Your court will take my court to court. The third court, which of course is someone else's court, and we subscribe to whichever court we want to subscribe to.
The subway guy would be on his 15th court now. You see how much more efficient that would be?
All right, let me start with this. We're going to do a teaser Wednesday today, too, folks. It's going to be a little bit short for you freebies. Probably, that usually doesn't end up working out, but that's what we're going to attempt to do. Sometime back, in fact, multiple times on this program, we've interviewed Professor William Luzonic of UMass. And I can't remember when the last one was. Maybe one of my producers will look that up. Yeah. But in both those interviews, if we've only done two, maybe we've done three, we've covered the notion of work he has done in trying to determine what has caused the stagnation of wages for workers, broadly speaking, and what has caused the explosion in CEO pay over the past 30 years or so. And he has determined that it's really sort of, it's multiple things, but it sort of cascades from the change in the tax structure where capital gains would be taxed at a rate far less than income earned from work. And this changed the pay structure for CEOs and board of directors, wherein they would receive stock options or stocks as part of their compensation package. And this caused CEOs and board of directors to sign off on what these CEOs were doing to run their companies in such a way that they no longer perceived their, I guess, goals to be long-term, the long-term health of a company, the long-term development of markets for a company, the long-term stability of its workforce, because their compensation was tied into short-term and mid-term gains in the price of the company's stock. And, I mean, understand that a capitalist runs a company to make money. And that doesn't necessarily mean that the company has to make money. It means that they have to make money. Now, usually those two goals are parallel. But if a CEO can make money simply by cutting his workforce, increasing profits, starving research and development, you're not going to feel the impact of that for years down the road. However, your stock will see an immediate impact from that. Further, Luzonic, last time he was on, was talking about the stock buyback as another means in which to increase the value of your stocks. You have cash reserves. You have profits. Do you plow that money back into buying new machinery, research and development, employee training? Or instead, do you go on the stock market, buy back your stock, and increase the value of the remaining stocks? And who holds those stocks? You, as the CEO and the board of directors. And therefore, you make money. It's basically the way to think about this is like a side bet in poker in some way. Or a cottage industry embedded in a larger company. I mean, it's almost as if I guess if I owned the office that we were working in, and really my real income came from rental. So it really wouldn't matter whether or not this show succeeded or failed as long as it kept paying the rent. I don't have to derive, I'll get rid of all our employees here, and I'll just do a 15-minute show, and I'll just keep it as long as they pay the rent if that's my business. It's not a perfect analogy. So when we last spoke to Lozonic, he saw great problems with the stock buybacks, and it was not always the case that a company was allowed to buy its own stock. And the reason is quite obvious. Buying a bunch of stock pushes up the value of your stock. In other words, it manipulates the price of your stock. Coincidentally, those laws were changed in 1982, or I should say rule in this case, a regulation was changed in 1982 under, yes, the Reagan administration, the same time, same era, I guess I should say, that we had that massive drop in the capital gains taxes. David Dayan writing in The Intercept, I'll tell you something, when you have a piece where it's, where like, the words David Dayan and Bill Lozonic are in the same piece. I feel like I'm in heaven. The Securities and Exchange Commission has admitted it has no ability to enforce the main rule intended to prevent market manipulation when companies buy back their own stock, and no intention to do so. In other words, in 1982, SEC adopted the rule 10B-18. Which provided companies with a so-called safe harbor, or an exception, if you will, on the idea of potential criminal prosecution of market manipulation, or even civil prosecution of market manipulation, if they adhered to four principles or limitations. One is, you can't engage in the buybacks at the beginning or the end of the trading day. And I guess that's because that would have a greater impact on the market share of your stock. It would be there's a quality, I guess, of shock and awe if one buyer comes in, buys up a 30%, 40%, 50% of the average of trading volume of your stock in one fell swoop at one point in the market, early in the day or at the end of the day. I guess that's the theory. You've got to use a single broker for the trades. In other words, you can't spread it all around to try and hide it. It's got to be a certain amount of transparency. If they purchase the shares at an existing or prevailing market price, in other words, you can't try and actually say, like, whoa, are you selling that stock for our stock for $25? We'll pay you $27. And you have to limit the volume of the buybacks to 25% of the average daily trading volume over the previous 4 weeks. So I don't know if 10,000 shares of your stock trade every day on the past 4 weeks. One day it's 11,000, the next day it's 9,000, but the average is 10,000. You're allowed to buy back 2,500 shares. However, this has become a growing issue in the more progressive corners of the Senate. Bernie Sanders has been talking about this considerably. Senator Tammy Baldwin, Democrat from Wisconsin, sent a letter to SEC Chair Mary Jo White asking about the stock buybacks. And according to the letter sent back by the SEC, dated July 13th, Mary Jo White, the Securities Exchange Commission chair, says the SEC doesn't collect the data that would let it know whether companies breach these four principles. Performing data analysis for issuer stock repurchases presents significant challenges, White writes, because detailed trading data regarding repurchases is not currently available. In other words, it's the honor system. It's trust and verify without the verify. And it's not just trust and verify without the verify. It's trust and verify without the verify, without any capacity to verify, even if we had some reason to believe that we should verify. This is going to become a larger issue. And William Lozonik, that aforementioned professor from the University of Massachusetts at Lowell, says the companies have that information, but the SEC doesn't collect it. Of course, the companies would have it, right? I mean, it is stunning. You have plans now put forth by Bernie Sanders, which is to end buybacks. No more buybacks. You can't collect the data on those parameters that are supposed to make it safe. Who cares? End buybacks. Then you don't have to worry about it at all. He's called for that in a Boston Globe editorial. Hillary Clinton has issued a policy paper which would basically vow to increase that disclosure by these companies. But as Lozonik says, the practice is the problem. Whether or not they're doing it within those parameters is secondary. The idea of stock buybacks basically is manipulation in and of itself, regardless of whether you try and mitigate the impact of that manipulation. And as you know, if you have listened to any of those interviews with Bill Lozonik, it is creating perverse incentives for CEOs and directors of corporations. And the result of the pursuit of those perverse incentives is creating massive wealth and income disparity between, well, 99% of us and that 1%. So that is something that hopefully as we move into the debate era of the Democratic Party, we'll hear more of. I don't know that we will, but I would like to. And it's certainly something I think we're going to hear more in the Senate. Let me touch on this story, too, from Kansas, and then we'll go bye-bye to the freebies. Sorry. I'm sorry about that. Here it is. Let's talk first about Kansas. You know, In 2011, I believe it was, Governor Sam Brownback took office in Kansas and was advised by Arthur Laffer of the Laffer Curve. The Laffer Curve, of course, is that little piece of magic which shows that if you tax people, wealthy people, more, they will stop working because it's not worth their while. And so his plan was, let's get rid of all corporate taxes. Let's get rid of corporate taxes on S-corps, let's get, which are basically sole proprietorships, small businesses. Let's slash taxes on the rich. And what's going to happen is, even though you've cut those taxes, you're going to get so much more economic activity because you're going to be unshackling people. And because, you know, in the right-wing mind, if money goes to a government, federal or state, in their mind, what happens is it evaporates. It doesn't in any way create jobs. It doesn't in any way build things. It all just goes into the bank accounts or the mental bank accounts of bureaucrats and then sort of just dissolves into the ether or something like that. I'm not exactly sure what it is. It's out of the private economy. And now in some other economy, I guess in some parallel universe from which the benefits cannot cross that temporal and spatial plane. So they cut all those taxes. And Kansas continues to have a far worse economy than the states around it and the rest of the country. By any measure, non-farm payroll employment, average hours worked in manufacturing, unemployment rate, wage and salary disbursements deflated by the consumer price index. Kansas has underperformed the U.S. economy ever since Brownback instituted his policies. Right. Now, the only other, I guess, phenomena that has come from this is massive cuts in spending to education and to infrastructure projects, everything that you would want if you were a citizen of a state, has now been rolled back. And they're suffering from massive deficits. Now, of course, in states, you got to balance the budgets. So it's on the backs of huge cuts to public services. And that dovetails nicely with a story on how in Kansas, in addition to other states, there is becoming a huge shortage of teachers, particularly in math, science, and special education. And why might that be? Well, first off, if you crap on people and tell them that they may not have jobs, I mean, all the testing and whatnot, and right now there's a case in the New York State Supreme Court where the test score evaluations for teachers being challenged based on the fact that the algorithms are a disaster and not terribly effective way of teaching, of evaluating teacher effectiveness. You make the professions less enjoyable, less rewarding, then you publicly shame them. We have, what, two or three Republican presidential candidates who are running one of their primary planks. Well, Chris Christie said, I would punch teachers in the mouth, or the National Teachers Union, the union that represents teachers, in the mouth. Scott Walker running on wanting to cut education to the bone. I don't know, Rick Perry, if he could ever remember one of those agencies. I think it was Department of Education he wants to cut. They run on demonizing teachers. You have this court case, the Viagra case, I believe it was, in California, which was to ostensibly attack the teacher tenure system. It's not like tenure at a college. It just basically says due process for firings. And the principle behind that case that the plaintiff was arguing is that kids in poor districts are getting a disproportionate amount of bad teachers. And the teacher tenure, the due process that these union contracts employ, make it impossible, in their words, or very difficult to fire these teachers, thereby making it impossible to hire better teachers. But there's a real problem just, I mean, stipulating everything that the plaintiff argues for the sake of argument here. There's another problem that they're not addressing. What makes you think there's a great teacher waiting to take that job that you have turned into a shitty job? And now we are seeing that there is a serious, serious shortage of teachers. And what's happening is states are basically rolling back their credential requirements. This is from the New York Times about a week ago. Louisville, Kentucky, Nashville, Oklahoma City, Providence, Rhode Island are among the large urban school districts having trouble finding teachers. Just 1 month before the opening of classes in Charlotte, North Carolina, they were trying to fill 200 teaching vacancies. Enrollment in California teacher preparation programs and number of credentials issued have declined steadily since 2008 in California. Nationwide, many teachers were laid off during the recession, but the situation was particularly acute in California, which lost 82,000 jobs in schools from 2008 to 2012, because it's impossible to fire teachers. This year, districts have to fill 21,000 slots. Are you really going to go into a job where the election of a Sam Brownback or a recession means that you are target number one to lose your job? Because, you know, we value teachers so much in this society. Education is so important. So, and would you go in as a student to a teacher's program and go into debt for this profession? It's pretty stunning. One teacher wrote in to Valerie Strauss. She's the education writer at the Washington Post. She's been teaching, believe, in public schools for a decade. Huge fan of public education, supportive of public education. She went into the teaching profession at age 40. She says that she has found it incredibly rewarding, but she writes, "I just can't work in public education anymore. I've been forced to comply with mandates from the Republicans at the state level, the Democrats at the national level, that are not in the best interest of kids. I'm tired of having to perform what I consider to be educational malpractice in the name of accountability. The amount of time lost to standardized tests that are of no use to me as a classroom teacher is mind-boggling. When you add in mandatory quarterly district-wide tests, which are used to collect data that is ignored, you get a situation beyond ridiculous. Number one on my district's list of how to close the achievement gap in increased learning, making sure that all teachers have their learning goals posted every day in the form of a, quote, I can statement. I don't know how we ever got to be successful adults when we had no I can statements on the wall. In addition, due to a chronic, purposeful underfunding of public schools here in Michigan, my take-home pay has been frozen or decreased for the past 5 years. I don't see the situation getting any better in the near future. No, I did not go into teaching for the money, but I also did not go into teaching to barely scrape by either. As a 10-year teacher in my district, I would be making 16% less than a 10-year teacher when I was hired in 2006. Let me repeat that. As a 10-year teacher in my district, I would be making 16% less than a 10-year teacher was when I was hired in 2006. I don't even know if she's adjusted that for inflation. The thought of any teacher having to take a second job to support himself or herself at any point in his career is disgusting. Yet that's what I was contemplating doing at 53 with a master's degree and 12 years of experience. She's gone on, I think, to go and teach at a private school. So that's part of the agenda there too, right? Let's drive the teachers out. Let's close the schools. Let's privatize it all so that we can have education for those who can pay. And for those who won't, we'll have warehouses, essentially. There'll be desks there, and there may be some chalk and a board, but there'll be warehouses. So, hopefully we're seeing some change in the reform movement, and hopefully the next Democratic president will have a slightly different perspective on what makes for a good education. But, you know, there's a lot of money that those Gates have, and they like to spread it around. All right, look, we're going to take a break, head into the fun half of the program, where I think what we'll do is there's one thing. Another guy in the TYT network who had a piece that someone had tweeted to me again and suggested I take a look at. And I watched at least part of it. And I'm not someone who really likes to get on teams and say I don't get into flame wars with teams of people. I like to occasionally with individuals, but not with teams of people. But there's one point I wanted to address in something that Kyle Kalinske had posted. And we will talk about that. Also, we got other sound, of course, and we're going to do a random rush, probably at the top of the show, the fun half. Folks, it's your support that makes this show possible. Become a member today at majority.fm or join the Majority Report. You can also go to support our sponsors. You can go to majorityreportkickback.com. Give if you buy crap from Amazon, the very least you can do is buy it through our link. We get a kickback. JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Everyone involved in getting that coffee into your cup, except for maybe the person who actually like puts it into the machine, because I don't know. That happens at your house or your business. Is paid a fair wage. And use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. JustCoffee.coop. The number is 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920. We'll take your phone calls. I'll take your IMs. Do you have the app? You should get the app. It's free. MajorityApp.com. You can IM us with one touch of the button. Also, every time you use the app, you're automatically signed up with all your information on Ashley Madison, which I'm not in favor of those their stuff being dumped out there. I don't care what they've done, but it does sound like somebody who went on there and got burned on that site in some way.
I did not have the affair that I was looking for. I love it. Someone so dumb to sign up for that service, but so smart to be able to hack it. It's a fascinating human being.
Right. It's true. What could possibly go wrong here?
I thought I'd have an affair with
the
blonde.
You know what?
Woman.
Apparently there were 33 million users.
Sure, a lot of those things are fronts and dummy accounts and all sorts of stuff.
They just have a bot that just like.
Also, how many people actually just signed up to see what was going on and never actually did anything with it?
But even still, 33 million people? That's a lot of people.
Sure, yeah, definitely.
Yeah, you think I'd be able to have an affair.
The person who did the hack and the dump. The issue seemed to be that it was a scam, claiming that it was all men on there. It really does sound like somebody got screwed. No pun intended. All right, we'll be right back.